Ammon, how does the Prince of Greed threaten Israel now?
The way of describing Israel's long-term economic position is to use the god of money. That's Mammon. In a long war, Israel can't survive. It's much too vulnerable to attacks on its energy supply. The offshore gas field, gas production platforms supply 70% of Israel's electricity. Hezbollah and Hamas have not attacked them yet. It's much too dependent on its ports for incoming cargoes to supply the country with the obvious human needs and also the needs of its manufacturing sector and so forth, and also to ship out its exports. The ports, Eilat in the south, has come under Houthi attack. Ashkelon is closed, close to Gaza. Ashdod, the major port, 70% of Israel's seaborne traffic goes through Ashdod, is subject to constant air raid alerts. Haifa and Tel Aviv ports are also affected. But by and large, one could say the attacks have been nuisance level. They have not been systematic. The Arabs are not yet fighting a long war against Israel. But in the long term, Israel cannot endure a long war. By long, Saddam Hussein long ago said to his general staff, the Arab world can fight a 3-year war. Israel can only fight a 1-year war. Whether it can even fight a 6-month war, because Saddam said that in 1983, that's a very long time ago, a generation ago in military technology terms. Whether Israel can survive a long war is doubtful. So the Arab strategy has to be to survive the current onslaught, the short war, which has genocidal race war elements we come to in a minute. The Arab side must survive to go on fighting. If it can survive and continue a long war, then Israel will be the loser. It'll win the battle but lose the war. That's the Mammon part.
Well, and do you think that's the intent, though, for Israel to wage a war? I mean, I know every party to war says initially, "Well, we'll be done in a couple of months before the seasons change," and so on and so forth. But Israel seems to be intent right now on depopulating the Gaza Strip, and that seems like a short-term project that the Americans are. Seem fully capable and willing to assist them in.
Short answer, yes. Israel has to fight a short war. All of the wars Israel has fought against the Arabs since 1948-49 have been short because the capacity of the small state to survive a long war surrounded by its enemies and much larger populations, its capacity to survive a long war has always been short. The capacities of the United States, logistical, military, and political, to continue supplying Israel will also begin to attenuate the longer this goes on. I can just point out, as we break through the fog, not it isn't a fog of war, it's a blackout of war. The United States is delivering aircraft supplies to Israel at a rate of roughly half. One flight every half hour. One flight every half hour over the current weekend. We're speaking on Sunday evening, Vancouver time. As of now, that's the level of the US resupply by air. We know that the fleet with the USS Ford is offshore to guard the sea approaches southwest of Cyprus. So the long-term capacity of the United States to support Israel in this war is already attenuated to the extent of severely straining US capacity to support the Ukrainian war against Russia. There are reports, I think they're reliable, that in order to avoid U.S. casualties at the far-flung U.S. land bases in Syria and Iraq. The U.S. is withdrawing U.S. troops from those bases while attacking them in apparent retaliation. That's called retreat under fire. So there have been credible reports that the U.S. can't logistically sustain a long war in support of Israel. If you don't mind, I think we need to preface what we're saying here at this time of the day, wherever you are listening, that things move very fast and there is a great, great deal we don't know. But blackout, which is the prevailing doctrine of the Anglo-American, French, German press, is part of the Israeli war plan. It's genocidal in the sense that, in the direct sense, defined as a crime in the UN conventions, with the aim of displacing more than a million people from their land and killing indiscriminately all over the Gaza civilians and so-called military targets. To black that extent of that operation out is part of the race hate crime, a cover-up for genocide that we're watching and listening to, indeed on French television, supported by the network. A Franco-Israeli journalist called Nili Kupfer Nauri called for the killing of all Palestinian children in the wombs of their mothers. I've never heard such a race hate statement since the records of what the Germans did to the Jews, the Russians, and everyone else who got in their way during the World War II. But race hatred crimes are being broadcast on French television, on British TV, and as we know, the police forces of those countries are doing their best to stop the demonstrations. So we are facing a great deal at this very moment of what we don't know, and blackout is part of the Israeli-American plan. We do know a number of things, and we can get to those in a minute.
Well, yeah, despite the best efforts of in France and the United States and in Canada and Britain, hundreds of thousands came out into the streets in protest calling for their governments to change their policies, to bring pressure upon Israel to stop the killing. I mean, that was there was no nuance to it. It was ceasefire, and that was the message. Of course, there was a lot of other things read into it. People charging that this was anti-Semitism and the rest of it, but the main push of, and this was all over the world, not just in Europe, but in other countries where demonstrating for Palestinian rights is not yet criminalized, were coming out in their tens of thousands in India, massive turnouts in Kerala and other places too. And the anger of the people is turning not towards Jewish people, as some are claiming, and seeing that online. Oh, I'm terrified when I look at these demos because I'm a Jew, and this looks like it's going to begin a pogrom or some such. But the anger, the ire of the people in the streets seems focused on their own governments, especially in India, where they were calling out their own leadership for not standing up for human rights internationally, and that can be said in this country, Canada as well.
Yes, this level of genocidal race hatred warfare, which the Israelis are perpetrating, generates extraordinary concern, domestic political conflict in all the countries in which there are significant groups of Muslims, for a start, and also for people who understand the criminality of this war. It's the old notion that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic is finished now. When Israel commits these sorts of crimes, criticism of Israel and of the Jewish diaspora, which supports the crime and broadcasts it with their demonstrations in these countries, has ended for good. The notion that to criticize Israel or Jewish doctrine in support of Israel is anti-Semitic has ended the value of the term anti-Semitism as a race hatred crime, so long as it's obvious that race hatred crimes against Muslims, Arabs, Palestinians are not only tolerated, but encouraged by the same media and the same governments which have made race hatred criminality or so-called anti-Semitism a political bellwether in their countries. The kinds of things being said by the Israelis would be a race hatred crime in England and ought to be. However, we've seen anti-Semitism as a race hatred crime used by the British press to kill off the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, the previous Labour leader. So the politics in each country is different, and we can go from one to the other, from London to Florida, from Florida to Paris, and so forth. The problem is that as big as these demonstrations go, the domestic political impact on the government supporting Israel is relatively weak still. Yes, the United. If you look at the way the UN voted, UN General Assembly voted last week, you can see that countries like Fiji joined the United States and Israel in voting against the ceasefire humanitarian aid resolution. The abstainers included everyone in the NATO alliance in the race war against race hatred war against Russia, the United Kingdom, and so on. So the domestic politics of this terrible war are dividing big communities. But I'm not here on your program, Chris, to talk about countries I know less well than my own. The Russian situation has parallels. Russia is trying to balance, or at least the Kremlin is arguing, and the foreign ministry is arguing, for a series of balancing resolutions to save the people of Palestine and the Arabs from genocide, to stop the Israeli shooting, to bring in life-saving humanitarian aid, but at the same time not take sides in what would be and will be a bigger war. And Russia, too, has its Muslim concerns. These were demonstrated over the weekend. There is now a flight between Mahachkala and Dagestan and Beirut, and the police were in Dagestan called to stop large busloads of potential volunteers from all over the Muslim Caucasus flying to Beirut to join up. That happened over the weekend. Mr. Kadyrov, the president of Chechnya, said at the beginning of this war, October 10, that he supports Palestine, his people support Palestine, and they're willing to participate in a peacekeeping operation if called on. This is the best he could do, and he's been silent ever since. In other words, Muslim Chechnya is staying very carefully silent. There is a serious problem if the Muslims of Russia understand that the government is taking the Israeli side here. So the government is not. However, and this is very frequently misunderstood in the so-called pro-Western bloggers that you can read in the US and Canada and Europe, what's happening is a very significant difference of assessment on the part of the Russian general staff from the assessment of the Kremlin and President Putin. The mediator between the two is the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. And you have to read what Lavrov is saying, including an interview he gave, an interesting one he gave in Minsk, Belarus, over the weekend, which is misinterpreted abroad, but it means that Lavrov is mediating between the two different assessments in Russia. But all politics is domestic. That's a cliche. And so is genocidal war by the United States and Israel against the Palestinians and the Arabs. And each of these different countries are approaching this problem differently. And the anger obviously grows, but so is the death toll. and so is the destruction. So you could say the demonstrations will grow, but the governments are not showing, some governments, most NATO governments are not showing that they're making a difference, that the demonstrations are making a difference. There's some signal that in France, the Macron administration is trying to establish a French-escorted seaborne humanitarian operation between Cyprus and either the Egyptian ports, like Port Said, or the Gaza port, which is under constant Israeli attack. The French are doing something more than sitting on their hands or supporting the Israeli attack, which is what the British are doing, using the British bases in Cyprus, or obviously the United States is doing. The Italians have clearly sided against the Arabs, against the Palestinians, for the US side, and all the US bases in Italy are being a part of the logistical supply chain, feeding the Israeli killing machine. This is what's happening. And if the demonstrations moved out of the center of London or in front of the Israeli embassy to the military bases that are being used in those countries, a slightly different impact would be visible.
Yeah, well, when you mentioned the United Nations General Assembly vote, Canada was in line with the other NATO countries in abstaining from that in that vote, but not before the Canadian government put forward an amendment to the resolution calling for a ceasefire over Gaza to try to water things down and to politicize the resolution to focus on solely Hamas and leave Israel out of the finger pointing as though they were merely reacting. And this is a line we often see when you talk, though, John, about the effects of the mass protests not having an effect. Well, one effect that they do have, yes, they're not changing the minds of the local governments, the satraps of the United States and NATO and so forth. And I saw Mark Regev, Israel's spokesperson. He was asked point blank if these demonstrations around the world have any effect on Israeli policy making. And he just said, no, we don't pay attention to that at all. But it does have an effect in places like Canada where it undermines the authority of the government here in the minds of the people. We look at our government and we wonder, well, they speak a big game when it comes to rules-based orders and so forth, the new euphemism or replacing international law. But when the rubber hits the road, when it's one of their friends, then all of these rules go out the window. It's clear to anybody that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide. It falls under, I mean, that word is beaten around so often, it's devoid of meaning. But in this case, it is a literal example, meeting all of the parameters of the original meaning of the word, and it is escalating. So I'm arguing that there is an effect, although it's too subtle right now to help the thousands dying under the unrestrained bombardment of Israel, but it's something. It's something more than zero.
I agree with you, Chris. You put it very well, and you put it to inspire our listeners not to diminish the effect of the protests. What I'm saying isn't different, and I'm certainly not saying the protests shouldn't be enlarged. All one can do is the best one can do where one is. My point is a bit slightly different to stretch the time period. These demonstrations, if kept up over a long war period, will have a cumulatively greater effect. The magnitude of impact of domestic popular resistance to governments committing genocide, collaborating in genocide, capo behavior, we used to call it during the concentration camps period of World War II. Over time, if the Arabs can maintain a resistance and go on fighting despite the genocide, the domestic demonstrations in Canada, in civilized countries, will have their effect. The political worm will turn.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking again with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Some of his many book titles include Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, salient especially right now. And his latest article at Dances with Bears we're talking around today is The Gods The Gods Are Going Against the Chosen People. Mammon against Israel, Mars against the Pentagon. Well, John, now in your article, you say that the Palestinian or Hamas strategy, and I think there is a point to be made about the discernment between those two, is in this latest offensive, is just, quote, destroying Israel's capacity to survive in its present state in a long war. Does Hamas, I mean, I'm not sure if that's right or not, but does Hamas even have the capability to sustain anything longer than, I mean, even today, even for the rest of this week, let alone a year? We're seeing what's being fired, at least what I'm seeing. I know there's a lot being blacked out, as you mentioned, but are just these the Qassam rockets that are metal bars without explosives. I mean, it's like what we've seen for decades. It doesn't seem like... Well, it seems like Hamas has pretty much shot its load here.
I'd have to say I don't know the answer to your question. These are fair questions, Chris. You're right to put them and put them on air and in public. It's been many years since I was engaged directly in Arab politics, and you see all sorts of pseudo-experts popping up in the Western press at the moment, claiming to know how Hamas thinks, how Hamas relates to the Palestinian Authority or the Fatah group, which runs the West Bank, how Hamas, Fatah relate to the Hezbollah and the Lebanese politics, how they relate to Iran, and so forth and so on. It's foolish to try to become a master in 5 minutes of Arab politics. I spent, 20 years at it and then stopped roughly in 1990. But the book The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, documents the history, not of Israeli destruction of the Arabs, but American destruction of the Arabs before Israel came into existence. I don't pretend to know what I haven't been following since for a long time. And it would be improper for me to guess about what Hamas's capabilities are. I can only say the obvious. Hamas has been planning this for a long time, at least a year, with all sorts of supply and advice strategically and tactically from Arabs and the Iranians. These people do not think in short term. They've stopped. They anticipated what would happen. Whether they're capable of resisting the level of bombardment and destruction, a combination of Israeli, US, and NATO destruction of the intensity Israel is inflicting on the concentrated Gaza Strip, I don't know. What I can say is that for the time being, what we're seeing the Arabs not doing, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Iraqis and Syrians, and behind them the Iranians, what we're seeing them not doing is what we know. We can see they're not attacking Israeli airfields to disrupt the incoming U.S. supply. We see they're not attacking, as I said before, the offshore gas production platforms to shorten the amount of electricity Israelis depend on. We're seeing a nuisance level of attacks on the Israeli ports. We're seeing low-level attacks from Lebanon without a significant Northern Front engagement. And we're seeing low-level attacks, significant but still at the nuisance level, on U.S. bases in Syria and Iraq, but not yet in Jordan. Now, if that's what we know, Is it because we don't know that there's a plan to go escalate, or is it because there is Arab restraint and Iranian restraint from the big world war that would come if the Northern Front opens, the West Bank Front opens, the Southern Front opens, if and the Egyptians come in? We are very close to world war when that happens. Some of my respected Russian analyst colleagues warn of this, and they're on, let's call it, the Arab side. They're certainly not on the US side. So the restraint is Arab.
There's another option there too, or perhaps these attacks are taking place more frequently than you and I know, or anybody, and they're being kept in the dark because it's an embarrassment or for whatever reason. John, we're fast out of time for this segment. I want to carry on, but I don't want to go on without thanking Dimitri Lascaris for being here in the first half. And I want to quickly get your reaction. Now, you asked me to ask him a question. Dimitri lives in Greece. And you asked me to ask him, what's with the Greek passivity? You want to correct me on that word? The passive reaction of the Greeks regarding what's going on in Gaza right now, when they're more traditionally very vocal and get out into the streets in support of Palestine and Arab interests generally, when they're being oppressed in the ways, well, not even as extremely as they are now, but in the past. His brief answer was that he says, yes, the Greeks are getting out into the streets, but in smaller numbers, he admits. And he laments that after all these years of austerity and the betrayal by the socialist government, the Syriza government, that their spirit is essentially broken. What's your response to that answer?
Well, we've got to speak quickly. In the old days when I was in Prime Minister Andreas Papandreou's office, there was very active support for the Palestinians and very good relations, particularly with Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, and polite relations with Saddam Hussein of Iraq, a major oil supplier. Yes, I agree with Dimitri. The destruction of Greece by the Germans and by the United States and the European powers since Andreas died in 96, the destruction has been so thorough, there is no serious left-wing opposition, party opposition, to what's happening, to the traditional Greek support in the Levant of all the communities of the Levant, the Jews and the Muslims. There's been a destruction of the capacity to resist on the part of all the non-communist parties. What's left is, and these are the organizers of the protests outside the bases, is the KKE, the Greek Communist Party. The Greek Communist Party is mobilizing the young, the middle-aged, and the old to go to the base of Elefsina near Athens, which is a major logistic supply point for the U.S., to head eastwards to Lebanon and to Israel. In Crete, the Communist Party has mobilized demonstrations against the Souda Bay complex, a major naval nuclear-armed base supplying the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force. There is a level of Greek resistance that's so far dominated, organized, led and inspired by the Communist Party. And, of course, that's suppressed by almost all the Greek press and the television. I would agree with Dimitri, the reason isn't passivity, it's a generation of destruction in which the so-called Greek left has participated, collaborated, and profited from.
Well, John, as always, it's enlightening to speak with you. For this audience, I will recommend that you go to guerrilla-radio.com to listen to the full interview with John. And thanks again to Dimitri Lascaris for coming on in the first half. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This year's fund drive is over, but the link to donate is still live at cgsf.ca/donate. If you missed supporting our campaign in real time, it's not too late. Donate now, and thank you.